Something for the weekend on Saturday. How are you? It's Trina Murray here, and I'm delighted to have Louise Lennox on the line. She is well known from the restaurant. She's a fantastic chef. Well, a pastry chef, really, Louise, aren't you? And I was saying, like, on the promo during the week, I might have to kidnap you. You don't mind, do you?
You can kidnap me, no problem, because that means I can just leave my messy place at home and I don't have to look at it all the time. Because I have a two-year-old that's like the whirlwind, and just as soon as you try and organise anything, it's destroyed. So baking, I only get to bake when I'm actually filming. But the funny thing is, most people get really surprised. They're like, you can actually cook as well. It's like, yes, so you have to do full-time training when you're in college. I feed myself all the time and my family. I just specialise in pastries, mainly because it's so creative and it's so scientific, and I love science, and I'm dyslexic, so I'm highly creative. So that ticks two boxes for me. Pastries, I have a super sweet tooth.
But how are you not like 35 stone, Louise? Because if you're making cakes all the time, like, I'm probably going to gain 2 stone just by doing this interview with you.
Well, I actually don't make them all the time. So when I worked in restaurants a very long time ago, I did make them all the time, but you used to get sick of looking at them. So homemade ice cream, when I got my very first job when I was 16, I gorged morning, noon and night. And then after around a month, the novelty just wore off because there was no supply and demand. I was able to eat whatever I wanted. That scarcity feeling kind of went, and I kind of just got used to seeing everything all the time. So I definitely had cake for breakfast a lot, but these days, actually, you know what I bought yesterday as a big treat to myself, because I love clotted cream, and I bought that, and my highlight today is going to making homemade jam and scones, because although I can make many different things, they are one of my all-time favourite things to make, bake and eat.
Right, okay, what time should I call in, Louise, and send the address right now?
Half an hour.
I'm there.
So when you call in, there. I'm going to leave you at my tier. I'm just going to go out and get half an hour of peace and quiet to myself.
So come here to me. You were telling me there about your kids just before we came on air. And the funny thing is, I feel like I had something to do with these children being conceived and you meeting your husband in the first place.
Yes. So I met my husband on the 12th of the Christmas, and he was sober at pub 11, which was a surprise. When we got chatting, and then after I met him, I did a background check, because I knew a lot of people that he knew in general in the movie and the TV world, and I did a background check through your lovely husband, and I called him up after that out on a date record, and I was like, is he normal, you know? And I was like, does he have all his own teeth? And then I said, is there any stories I need to know about him? I was like, because you and Gordon are so well suited. And after, when we were getting married, I sent Nick a text going, this is partially thanks to you, and he goes, I won't charge it.
Isn't it so funny though, because he's kind of the chief organiser of the 12 pubs of Christmas. Well, they used to be massive years ago, and look, it used to be 100 people or 150 people at it, and everyone kind of mixing. And
every year Nick had invited me, and I could never go because I had a pop-up bake shop at the time, and this was a long time ago, so I'd be baking through the night to have beautiful fresh produce. And this is the first year that it snowed at Christmas time. And the very first time in my entire chef career that I went, I can't work on a Saturday in December. This is weird. What will I do? And then I remember going, Nick, that's 12 pubs you want this weekend. And I text him going, are these still on? He's like, oh my God, yeah. And I said, well, I know anyone. And he goes, you'll know loads of people. So I went in just completely off the fly to see what it was about. And I didn't even intend on staying. And it was snowing outside, and I'd be quite small and petite, so I had my snow boots with me to walk around the 12 pubs, and then I had my high heels to change into once I got inside the pub so people could actually see me in height.
And the funny thing is as well, like, I know Gordon separately. We would have been in London a lot together doing all the movie stuff, and it's such a small world.
Well, so I can vouch for him. Hit me up with any information afterwards, Trina. Like, I'll definitely supply you with cakes if I can get some stuff on him.
I'd have to make it up. There is nothing on him. Nothing to tell you. But listen, we're talking today because not only are you all about, you know, the caking and the cooking, but you're also about feeding fussy eaters. And you did a lot of training in this, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. So they say your mess becomes your message in life. So my son is 8.5 years old. And when he was a baby, I would have done everything that we're told by the book. You know, I breastfed him till he was 14 months old and everything was cooked from scratch. And he was eating fine. I mean, I remember thinking, oh, this parenting is feeding. It's so easy and it's enjoyable. And then when he turned 20 months, it was as if a new child walked into my kitchen. He just stopped eating. Now, it wasn't a complete refusal of food. It was gradual, but quite fast gradual, if that makes sense. So I remember the very first thing he refused, I used to make this like really delicious fruity curry, and he used to love it. And he started picking out the pieces of chicken, which was really unusual for him because he'd eat it all really fast. And then, so it started with chicken, and then it continued with other meat very rapidly. And then he was taking whole food groups out of his diet. And I was never aware, I was aware of fussy eaters, but it wasn't an area I knew much about. So I would have heard a lot of the myths, you know, oh, they'll grow out of it, just leave them alone. I tried that, it didn't work. Or, you know, give them the same food at the next meal because they'll have to eat it. Or, you know, let them go to bed hungry and then they'll wake up hungry. Like, I did every single wives' tale myth and I busted them all because they don't work.
He'd be starving and he still wouldn't eat it.
Yeah. God. No, he would, and that's the kind of thing. Oh, if they're hungry, they'll eat. They won't. And what I've learned from all my training is children can learn how not to eat as well. I put him on timeout. I used to punish him for not eating. I tried getting a reward chart for him not eating, and it started getting worse and worse. And he was getting really pale, and his clothes were getting loose on him. And so I said to my husband, I said, I'm going to bring him to the doctor, because there wasn't that much information there. There was a lot of very helpful friends and family giving you like what they felt was right, but nothing worked. Mm. And with my food background, years ago, after I stopped working in restaurants, I went back and studied diet, health and nutrition in Kevin's, DIT, Kevin Street. So I knew an awful lot from that course, but it wasn't really focusing on children, is much more adult nutrition. And we did do a bit of children's nutrition, and I just knew gut feeling from a mother first of all, and then from everything that I learned and in the food industry that I'm in, that there was something up. So I was really, really lucky. I went to my doctor, and I have heard some people, because they're not well versed in this, don't really take it that seriously. I'm lucky because my doctor listened to me. So he was losing weight, and she said that there's a hospital program, you know, you can get him on, but the only bad news is it's a year's wait. And so he got even worse within this year. So I said, yeah, signs up to the program. And then when we started the program, it opened my eyes, so much so that I asked the doctors and the occupational therapists and the speech and language pathologists and the dietitians where they trained. And I went over to America and trained with the same lady that they did their training with, because I just felt so passionate, because I never, like, so food is my life. I'm dyslexic. And food, my teacher used to get me to bake cakes for my homework, not every night, but to reinforce and empower that I was good at something. And it really helped me when I was in primary school and didn't have much confidence. This really boosted my own confidence and self-esteem. And it stayed with me my whole life. And I worked with children, with your husband, doing kids TV shows and RTE and devising recipes and formats for them. And then I come to this point in my life thinking we're going to have all these beautiful memories, and so many memories are related around food, and my child won't eat. And then I started feeling that I'd done something wrong as a parent.
I know, you start feeling like a failure, like, yeah, if it was me, oh, now, Louise, I'd be thinking it was just my bad cooking, but we know that you can cook, so it's not the taste of the food.
And you're looking at the blank page of going, what? And like, the three things in life that we cannot force children to do, you cannot force them. You cannot force them to sleep, you cannot force them to go to the toilet, and you cannot force them to eat. There are three things you cannot physically do. And so it was only then, from going over to America, I did intensive training, and then I did continual training. And it was then learning that this is actually a massive problem, that I wasn't the only parent, that 50% of parents at some point in child's development will present their child has got fussy eating. There's different levels of fussy eating. You can have picky eaters, they'll eat typically 30 foods or more, or you can have problem feeders, which was the area that Alex fell into. They eat 20 foods or less. Alex is worse, he ate 10 foods. So from food that saved my life and gave me my career or my passion, and I met my husband through, suddenly was destroying my family. I mean, I remember like crying over my child not eating, going to bed, dreading having to like get up for breakfast in the morning and what was going to face me trying to sleep
every morning,
my child.
Guess. Yeah.
And, oh, six times a day. And why do you keep saying, if we fought with our partners six times a day, we'd probably be heading to the divorce courts. Because you wouldn't want to live in that world. And all I want to do was feed my child, nurture my son, and give him the gift of enjoying food, because so much of food that we love is based around, you know, festivals and birthdays. You bring out a cake and it's food. Like, he wouldn't eat cake. And a lot of people, and this wives' tale, they've this misconception that if they're a fussy eater, they only eat what people would, you know, deem as junk food. So, you know, fast food, highly processed food, frozen pizzas, chips and chicken nuggets. My child didn't eat any of these, you know, or all they eat is, like, you know, what they deem as cheap food. So, you know, it's cake and it's ice creams and jellies. He didn't eat any of these foods either. So I can foremost tell you, at his worst, he ate white bread, white pasta with nothing on it. Fish fingers became like my lifeline. Mm-hmm. He also would have eaten Rice Krispies, milk, cornflakes.
So these are all butter. Kind of beige colours, aren't they? Is there something in that?
And crunchy texture. So a lot of children, oh, there's my little two-year-old coming in talking about food. So a lot of sound effects here. Real life. So a lot of people wonder why it's crunchy foods. It can be sensory. It's easy for children to manipulate them, put them in their mouth, and it's a texture they get used to. And it's easy for them to kind of manipulate in their mouth, bite and swallow as well, are the crunchy textures. And they're normally always the same, whereas, say, fruit or vegetables can be cooked differently. Even from the way I cook a day, say, I steam carrots, and tomorrow they could be maybe slightly steamed more than they were yesterday. So their texture, you can never determine, has always been the same. Whereas a crunchy food, you can. And then a lot of crunchy food comes in packets that are more fun for kids, so they can become more used to seeing these. These become more familiar, safe foods for children. I mean, there is a whole, and I'm not exaggerating, there is a whole psychology and science, which I just love, all around how we eat, how we feed our kids, how they eat, which is why I think that when I started on this road of fussy eating, the reason I went over to America wasn't even to start this as a new business. I just wanted to help my son. I just wanted to help him, to give him the foundation of good food, that when he grows up, I know that I've done everything I can to ensure that he has a long, healthy lifestyle. Yeah. That was all I wanted.
So tell me, what was the key then, and how is he now, and what stage are you at now?
So as I sadly realised, there is no magic wand. So when I started this program, I went in so optimistic, and I remember speaking with the doctors, and there was this amazing speech pathologist in there, Ruth. I mean, I just love and adore her. And I was so naive. I was like, so I really wanted to eat these foods. How long do you think it's going to take? And after this session, what am I going to cook for dinner? And they said, slow down. It's very gradual exposure. I had to make food like involved in all of our world. So I learned an awful lot. They gave us parents education, and it was really about taking down our expectation and starting where the child is. Like, there's 75 common reasons why children don't eat. So it's not just, people think it's behavioral, that they're being bold, or they're trying to control you, or you know, they are trying to assert and test boundaries, and that's actually not true. I mean, I think Alex's came from, he got croup, and I feel that it was very sore for him to eat, and he linked food with being painful, and that can actually turn them off food very, very fast. Or they could have, like, constipation, pain, very badly constipated. They can have oral motor problems, and they can have problems like swallowing food, or they can't chew the food properly. That poor oral motor strength has a massive problem on actually breaking down your food in order to swallow it. Sensory processing is a big reason why kids mightn't be into food. And we all are kind of sensory eaters. So when I started on this role, the first thing I actually had to do was change the seat that he sits in. And I was like, you change a seat? Are you serious? And I had one of those, you know, those trip-trap stokey chairs, and I gave it away because he hated it. So they're like, so you need to get another one of those if you can. I was like, okay. I was desperate. I would have tried anything. And that was to help their postural stability. So up to this point, he would have sat on a chair with his legs under his bum. But this has always stayed with me. So if you're out having dinner and you go into a restaurant and it's really busy and they say, look, the only seat we have available is at the bar, and you're at the bar stool, most people you know, if they're really hungry, they might accept it. But it always feels like the second way of sitting down.
I would always
say
no
really
to
enjoy
that.
Your meal.
Yeah, I would always say no to that.
I would say no.
I'd feel like you're being pushed out the door kind of as well if you're given that particular one. Yeah.
There's that point, but I think a lot of people don't realise until you try it. And anyone that is listening, I would urge you to try this experiment if you can. If you have a bar stool, so a lot of people have islands and a bar stool, sit down at your island and let your feet dangle. Don't put them on the bar. We naturally, when we sit down at the bar stool, we look to place our feet on the bar so they're supported, so our feet are flat when we eat. We don't realise it because it's subconscious. And that gives us stability. So what we are doing is we are focused on what we're eating. We are not risking falling over and possibly injuring ourselves. And children are the same. When their feet dangle, they're not supported in a 90-90 position, so that their torsos to where their knees are and then over to where their ankles and their feet are. And they're just trying to stay upright. And that's really distracting if they're trying to eat, because they're just trying to concentrate on that. It's all very subconscious. Mm. They wouldn't be able to tell you that if you asked them.
Yeah.
But also, feet dangling is very, very distracting for kids. And they don't realize that distracts them. And also, sitting with their feet under the bum is very uncomfortable. And they shift a lot in their seat. You know, you'll often hear parents, I was one of those parents, you're like, stop fidgeting. But even at home, you can put a cushion behind your child if they're sitting in a chair or if they're sitting at the counter. And you could even get, like, I've gone into houses and worked with people, and I've gotten, you know, children's toy boxes, like, you know, those toy boxes, the hard plastic ones, and we've turned a few of them upside down and stacked them where it reaches their feet, so their feet are just flat on something. There's many things that you can do that you can find around the house, or the little steps that some children might stand on to brush their teeth are fine, or the small little toddler chairs that they possibly have grown out of, that's good for sitting, that's it underneath the table that their feet can rest on.
There's so many things that are nothing to do with food.
And that's what I found incredibly fascinating. I think from my world of food as well, Jean, it kind of came full circle, because I was in the area of, I've worked with children for years. I worked on kids' TV shows. I have developed recipes. I was going to schools and I was teaching kids, you know, how to learn about food. But I never knew the world of fussy eating. And because Alex was the problem feeder, and as I said, at his worst, he ate 10 foods. I mean, in a sense, the only way was up, but I was like this 5-star, you know, number one student on this, because I was willing to try anything. So I took it really, really seriously, because, I mean, I just couldn't face going on, you know, a cigarette of it. Is that like, what, 10 years I have to do and argue with my son and dread every mealtime?
I know.
What's it going to affect him growing up, because
and
he's
him
not
losing weight and everything
nutrients.
He's losing weight and he's
losing weight. Yeah. And that was scary. I mean, his constipation was really, really bad. He had to go on medicine to deal with his constipation because he had a fear of going to the toilet because it was so painful. So everything has cause and effect and a knock-on effect. So when you're thinking about how do you encourage children to eat more food, the very important thing is it's not overnight. And it took a long time for me to understand that and actually get my head over, because I really wanted this fixed in 2 weeks' time, and it wasn't. And then when I accepted that, I took a lot of the pressure off Alex and I took it off myself as well, and appreciate, like, this is where we're starting. And it's like learning any, it's like they have to learn, because a lot of people think eating is you naturally learn how to do. You actually don't. Breathing is the body's number one function, and what we know how to do automatically. Babies, yes, they learn how to eat, but then when children get that little bit older, they have to learn how to chew and swallow. And that's why speech is very important with learning how to eat, because they use a lot of their tongue muscles and they're learning how to talk, which then helps them when they graduate onto like harder foods. So it's like swimming. You don't bring a child in on the first day and throw them in the deep end, because they're probably not going to have a good experience or want to go into the water again, and it's dangerous. So you start by letting them look at the water, and food is the exact same. It was a long process. They played with an awful lot of foods, manipulated foods, deconstructed foods. But little by little, you know, for instance, Alex even comes to the table at mealtime. It terrified him. And so the number one thing you can do is start trying to eat as a family. And if that means that you have to serve your child one safe food or one prepared food at every meal. So if you are having a Chinese food for your dinner that you've prepared, and your child will only eat plain pasta. You have to serve it at the table, but you don't serve it on their plate because that still kind of is, I call it like the invisible food screen, where it's your food versus my food, and we don't really share. We're sitting here together, which is a good start, but we're not really sharing food. So it's called family style dining. You put all of the food in bowls at the table and you pass them around, like pass the parcel, and your child has the right to decide if they're going to put that food on their plate or they can introduce a learning plate. And that's how I got Alex back up to the table. Like my first Christmas dinner with him sitting at the table, he'd pasta with tomato ketchup and we all had our own food. We have to take some of their food, so you can't have this secret of food.
You'd plain pasta with tomato ketchup as well.
That's essential. Because I remember hearing this going, oh my God, like my kitchen really is messy. Now I've got more, like, you know, not only cooked food, I've put it in individual bowls and I've got so much extra work. And after 2 weeks, it takes you 2 weeks to get used to introducing a new routine or a new habit. It's 2 weeks.
Okay.
So after 2 weeks, it just became part of making dinner. And
kind of like the Sunday or the Christmas dinner or whatever. Like we would kind of pass around the bowls of the whatever, the potatoes, roast potatoes and the veg and the, and everyone takes whatever they want, doing it that kind of way.
Absolutely. But we normally only do it at Christmas time and people are stressing out for the month and gearing themselves up. But in the reality, it's normally only a few, you know, cereal bowls. You might have one, you know, slightly bigger bowl you're going to put your potatoes in or your rice or whatever it is. But it's just what this gives is it gives children repeat exposure. When you eat food, the last part, like everything, you put food in your mouth, you chew and you swallow. That's actually the end. There's 32 steps to eating food. And the first step is that you actually see the food and you allow it like close to you. Because some foods used to make Alex run away from the table in tears. And I'm not exaggerating saying that. Like it was, it was a really low point for me as a parent. Yeah. And for me, as food,
food that, lover,
like, you know, was my life and career.
Yeah.
So I was like, yeah, we'll try that. So we changed the chair. We brought in trying to eat together more. And you act as, like, it's called social role modeling. So children learn by watching parents or watching their peers or older people do things. So they learn to get dressed, you know, how to hold a pen, how to colour in, how to play with toys, all this type of stuff. So food is no different. And so I made a point of trying to have as many meals as possible where I'm physically sitting down beside them. And even if I didn't want to eat, like, or wasn't hungry, I take a little bit of the food. And then the other part of it was to always make sure that you have protein, carbohydrates, and fruit or veg at the table. Again, if they're not going to eat it, but it's repeated exposure and giving them variety and to stop them from grazing. So I put them on an eating schedule. So every 2.5 to 3 hours, you should feed your child. And we have this feeling that we need to constantly offer them snacks. And the problem with that is they are not necessarily hungry come to the table. If they're not hungry come to the table, they're not that motivated to eat. They're not used to their hunger cue. So it was me trying to teach them hunger cue. So one great tip I can give to people that you can start today is if you're finding even in the morning time, breakfasts are a nightmare because sometimes kids can get over hungry and they're not hungry, or they get over hungry and we've all had children being incredibly cranky and it's actually because they're hungry and they're not necessarily, you know, in bad form, is 20 minutes after a child wakes up, you offer them breakfast. 20 minutes, you need to time it. So if they're up at 7, you offer them breakfast at 7:30. Yeah. And you try and keep them on that eating schedule and cut out the grazing. And another thing as well is we need to take away having the child the focus of meals. I know I did it all the time. So you're watching, you're going, oh my God, they're not eating. And you're watching, and you're commenting of what they're putting on the plate, what they're not putting on the plate, how much they're eating. 2 more scoops, please. Put 2 more forks. And we start to, I mean, like, if I could have paid my child to eat, I would have, you know, bribery, corruption, conflict, fighting. And what this does is nobody wants to be the centre of attention. So I tried to bring food back to not talking about food necessarily at the table. You know, you can say, oh, you know, the potatoes are, you know, really creamy mash, but not making them the focus of the meal and then trying to have a bit of a normal conversation that isn't always about food, as you would if you're going out for dinner.
Yeah.
Because what happens, I find it fascinating, I learned this, is when you're upset or excited, you release adrenaline, which shuts off your appetite. So most brides, the morning of their wedding, don't eat breakfast. They can't because you're so excited. Coming up to exam time, or if you're going for a job interview, you normally can't eat or focus properly because you've got adrenaline pumping around your veins. So at meal times, if there's an awful lot of conflict and upset, children actually genuinely won't be hungry because it's been shut off because of the adrenaline. They're on fight or flight mode. and no matter how much trying to eat feed them won't happen. And then when you're nervous like that, your mouth goes dry, so they've reduced saliva production, which means swallowing food will actually be really, really difficult as well.
So Louise, after really, really taking this seriously, because I mean you had to, and training in this, how is your son now, Alex, and how's he getting on with the food?
A massive improvement. I mean, he ate calamari for me the other day, and prawns,
what?
And last night, like you must think I'm so emotional, but Alex came home and he never really wanted to go into the kitchen, didn't want to cook, although I had all these like lovely premonitions when I was pregnant, so we're going to cook every day together. And he made, he asked, could he make a fried egg, which he was always averse to, was eggs and toast. And he flipped over the egg himself, and he made Gordon and myself and himself and his little sister fried eggs yesterday for lunch, which was just one of the proudest moments for a mother who's had a child with so many food aversions. And every day when he will try something new or he'll engage with a new food, it might necessarily be chewing and swallowing it, it makes me feel excited, because we were on the verge of like never feeling we get to this point. So there is massive amount of hope for people. There really is. Like, this, it does work. It just takes time. Like learning any new skill, it takes time. And then one of the first things I did, because he was missing, I knew he was missing nutrients from his diet with being so restricted and with him being fussy. And this is what a lot of parents do with fussy eating children, or children that just don't always eat everything, is I put him on a multivitamin, the first thing I did. And from a fussy eating child, he didn't want to eat the little multivitamins that they come in. So I put him on a tonic, because I was able to put it into his juice, and then he got used to, he was able to take spoons of it. It was a game changer for us. It really was. And I was able to, it was the one thing I was able to go to bed at night time thinking, at least I'm supporting his health. I feel that I'm doing something to make him better in the long run, even if he might be eating all the fruit and veg.
So what's the name of that supplement you were using?
So I put him on Vivio Junior multivitamin tonic. And the other thing as well was I wanted to build up his gut health. I mean, there's so much more research going into gut health nowadays. Like 70% of children's immune system is actually located in the gut. I mean, when I realised that, I actually couldn't believe it. I started reading this book a couple of years ago. It was fascinating. So I wanted to build that up as well. And he was more susceptible to getting sick, because he used to get croup every year and he'd be on antibiotics. So I wanted to boost that gut flora. So I actually put him on a live bacteria supplement. So Vivio Junior, they've a range out called Tummies, and it's a multi-strain live bacteria supplement. And it's really good for helping boost your gut flora, especially with more kids. We're coming into autumn and winter time, and like on average kids miss 9 days of school, so I definitely want to make sure Alex does them, and then he gets into as many days of school, because when he's in school, that's when I get to work. So I need him to go to school.
You need him out of the house.
Come
here to me. Speaking of working, Louise, you just wrapped up filming on The Restaurant.
We did. Yeah. Oh yeah, we filmed that a couple of weeks ago. This is my first year. This is our first year back since COVID, because it was cancelled during COVID. So we joke, oh, the band's coming back, because we are like a family that we get together at Christmas time. We all have big reunion, and then we don't see each other for another year. So it's lovely just seeing the lads in the kitchen again. And like, and it's not just the people that are on camera. There's a huge community of all of the production staff the other side of the camera, and we've been working with these production crew for years, and I genuinely get the loveliest fuzzy feeling in my stomach when I know The Restaurant's coming back. For the fact that on TV it's lovely, but for me it's really what goes into the show and behind the scenes and working on the show each day with all of the people that I now consider like members of my family. And it's a great show, and I love the fact that it is one of the only shows that we have on Irish television that is an original Irish format that has been sold around the world.
Off the top of your head now, Louise, I want you to be totally honest with me. Who was the best cook that you've ever seen in the kitchen, and the worst?
Michael Hooley Ray was one of the worst, I think.
Was he brutal?
I can't tell you. I can't remember his starter. I just remember desserts mainly. But like, he wanted to make Guinness ice cream, and he wanted to Guinness ice cream. And I remember saying to him, but you need to like reduce that down to get a Guinness extract flavour. And I'm thinking, I like wouldn't really be into eating Guinness ice cream myself. And he's like, no, I just want to pour the pint of Guinness into the ice cream.
Oh my God, they're like the Coca-Cola floats that you had when you were a kid. Remember when you poured the Coke into the glass of ice cream?
Yeah, kind of. But he actually wants to make the ice cream taste of Guinness. But I was trying to explain to him, again, going back to the science of how you bake and cook, that there'd be too much water content and you just end up like with crunchy ice cream that'd be disgusting. And he wouldn't listen to me. And so I have to make it his way. And then I have to make it my way for him to taste the difference until he went, okay, you're right, let's put that on the menu. So he was definitely the worst in the fact that it took an awful lot of convincing to explain to him that I'm trying to help him with his recipe and not sabotage us. You know what? And this is not saying who's your favorite child. There's been so many amazing, funny people that I've worked with over the years, and we've done so many series. I've been working on this show, Trina, since 2007, so that's a lot of episodes for me to try and remember guests from. Well, off the hand, who makes me laugh out loud? Gerald Keane made me laugh from the minute he came in through those doors to the moment he left. He is so charismatic and funny. I absolutely adore him so much. Very funny. For a solicitor, he's a very good cook as well. He knows an awful lot about food, and I know he throws lavish dinner parties. So he was genuinely into the food. Who else was very good off the top of my head? This is really Simon Delaney was hilarious in the kitchen. Like, I was crying so much that my fake eyelashes fell off and I still reapply them, and I don't like having to reapply makeup in a hot sweaty kitchen.
Sure, he's mad into his cooking and all now, isn't he? Like, he's really into it. Yeah,
big into cooking, like so into cooking. This year we just wrapped, and the people in the kitchen this year, they were so funny. Demi from The Young Offenders, she was hilarious, and this is one episode to watch because the dessert that she wanted to serve out to Marco was a portrait of Marco physically on the plate. I have never laughed so much watching somebody compile a dessert. And you're trying to be professional in the kitchen. And so, you know, we always let the guests put the dish together of how they see fit and what's in their memory and then or in their mind, and then we help them tweak it. And we do it during tastings, and it's not to be mean or to get personal, but we just want to actually help them to do the best they can. So Demi starts creating her dessert, and I could feel myself starting to laugh because they're going, oh my God, like she's just cut out one big square of banana cake and she's piping chocolate mousse that looks like something of bodily fluids. Oh, like right. You wouldn't want to do anything with it. And then she starts putting on these Maltesers and nothing. She goes, it's Marco's face there. That's his hair. That's his face. Well, once she started putting Maltesers on for eyes, I couldn't keep in the laughter, and I was trying to go, no, think of like the pets that have gone, think of all sad things. And then I could just feel myself trying to laugh more and more, and then I just broke into laughter, and then tears were rolling down my face. I'd actually go out to Roisin Duran, the makeup artist. She was doing Rachel's makeup. I was like, so can you just like make me not look like a panda anymore, please? Because I know my makeup's ruined from this episode. Her dessert is one to watch, absolutely. It is a showstopper, probably for all the wrong reasons.
I'm sure people are probably thinking, I wonder, is Roisin Duran anything to Maura? She is. She's her sister, because Roisin has helped me on occasion before when I've had a runny eyeliner getting the makeup done before.
She's amazing. Maura Duran's sister, was on as well. And her sister did a few years ago, so she said that she was in competition with her sister, and Dunica O'Callaghan did it as well. So for her, she just wanted to beat those two. She didn't care about anything else, but she wanted to be able to make sure that she held her head high and did it with those two. And she loves dessert, so we had the best time just like eating loads of chocolate, munching on crunchy caramel and making like dreamy caramel desserts. Oh, so good. Like, I just love it because I get to eat everything.
Louise, it's been brilliant catching up, all the things that we have in common. I'm surprised my husband didn't marry you though, given that you're such a good cook.
Well, you see, we were neighbours for a long time.
I know, I've heard all the stories of you bribing them with food.
So it'd be more like he'd be more like a brother figure to me. Oh. So marrying him would be kind of a bit weird.
That'd be weird.
So
okay.
I'm delighted that he gave Gordon a thumbs up, and I'm delighted that you also gave Gordon a thumbs up, because I did bet him before I went out on a date, and I'm not even exaggerating on
that. Come here, don't you have to these days? There's some crazy people out there.
Oh my God.
You have to do the background
check. Absolutely.
Yeah,
so some people are sold to you like used cars. Unless you take them out on a date, you realise half of the things don't work.
But you know, the worst thing is actually when from your single days, Louise, when someone says to you, oh, here's somebody that would definitely suit you, you'd be perfect together. And then this person walks in and you're like, what? Are you joking me?
Oh, yeah.
And you wonder if people really know you at all.
Oh, I know. That's why you have to be careful who you're friends with and who you accept to go on dates with even more.
See you. Bye. 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 Bye.